At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
In which the theme of the day is that as long as the rain is still falling, economic uncertainty is the watchword. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosedale, Monday, the 28th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The thing about this storm and its still unfolding aftermath is that other than that there's going to be a whole lot more rain in and around Houston, there is much we just don't know yet. In the key energy industry in southeast Texas, some of this country's biggest refineries have been taken offline. The Port of Houston and key shipping lanes are out of business. And the truth is, there is no telling how long it's going to be until we can get those facilities back up and running. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
Some 15% of the country's refining capacity is shut down for the storm. Today, wholesale prices for gasoline rose 7 cents a gallon. Not a huge spike. The country does have more than 20 days of spare inventory. But really, nobody knows when the refineries can restart. They could have flood damage, says energy consultant John Hours at Turner Mason.
Electrical systems, pumps, things like those, if those remain underwater, have seen water contamination for any length of time, we could potentially see extended outages like we saw during Katrina.
Extended as in a year, and that could crimp supplies to key places that rely on the Texas coast, like the upper Midwest and the Northeast. For now, there are no reports of big refinery damage in the country's key place for turning petroleum into fuels and petrochemicals and pharmaceuticals and plastics. Tom Tseng teaches energy business at the University of Tulsa.
Those are all leaving by tanker. The Port of Houston and the Houston Ship Channel at the present time are still closed. So all these massive movements of billions of gallons of product, essentially, are kind of at a standstill.
And now, Louisiana's many refineries are watching Harvey, says analyst Jenna Delaney at S&P Global Platts.
With the hurricane looking like it's heading back out into the Gulf of Mexico and could start moving up the coast towards Beaumont and even Louisiana, we could see some of that production go offline in the days to come.
Offline for how long? We may not know till the waters recede and the real damage is assessed. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We're still a long ways from figuring out the damage from Hurricane Harvey, but we do know a lot of people are going to need a lot of government help. At the federal level, response and recovery operations could wind up being spread across as many as 20 government agencies, but that bureaucracy was a key target during the presidential campaign, and a lot of key political appointments at those agencies have yet to be made. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more on that reality and the government's response to Harvey.
It's well documented that President Trump is behind schedule when it comes to political appointees. Max Steyer is the CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, which tracks government vacancies.
FEMA itself is missing its two deputy administrators, one position of which was created in response to Hurricane Katrina.
There are also vacant positions high up at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Federal Highway Administration, and a list of others.
These are all critical institutions in government that are very closely involved in the kind of disaster response that we need in Texas.
But much of the day-to-day work falls to civil servants who don't turn over with each new administration, says Richard Silves, author of the book Disaster Policy and Politics.
A lot of it involves preparedness work, planning work. Much of it involves recovery operations. More federal money is spent in recovering from disasters than in responding to them.
Many longtime federal employees are well-versed in the work of their agencies, and they're the ones tasked with filling in for missing appointees.
Somebody is sitting in that desk doing their job.
Robert Collins is a public policy professor at Dillard University in New Orleans.
The problem with that is that that's a career staffer that has another job. Now you have everybody spread too thin.
Collins says a disaster will test any organization, but vacancies could make some agencies slower and less efficient just when they need to be fast and nimble. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Harvey has displaced a lot of people. Some of those people have left town, others have nowhere to go, so a lot of those folks are winding up in shelters. One key difference, though, between Harvey and earlier storms is that after Katrina, emergency response officials decided they didn't want to turn huge buildings like the Astrodome into housing shelters. So where have those people gone, and what is the shelter strategy for Harvey? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Nobody said planning for disasters was easy. There's so many variables: population size, proximity to other major cities, safety. More than 6,000 people stayed in shelters last night, and the numbers will fluctuate over the next week. Anthony Tornetta is a Red Cross spokesperson. He says his group is just looking for the best option, doesn't really worry about the size of the structure.
It's a local high school gymnasium, or it's a local YMCA.
Then he says that's where people will be placed. Jeff Slegomelch is deputy director at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. He says even though FEMA and the Red Cross are trying to get away from housing people in huge structures like the Astrodome,
in some cases these larger mega shelters temporarily, because they're the best way to shelter a lot of people very quickly and to provide, to really focus your resources.
Tim Dixon is a professor at the University of South Florida. He says FEMA and the other groups providing shelter can't be all that choosy about where they put people, specifically in big population centers.
Say you have a million people and 10% of them need housing temporarily. That's 100,000 people. I don't know of any city that could easily come up with public spaces and beds for that scale of people.
And Houston's the fourth largest city in America, almost 2.4 million people. Craig Fugate is former director of FEMA. He says small to medium-sized shelters are ideal, but that's going to be tough in Houston.
You try to open those up as close as you can outside the hazard area, but if you look at where the rain's falling, that's such a large chunk of southeast Texas that you're really having to go far inland to find shelter capacity.
And that may not be easy either. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, capitalism continued unabated. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This week makes it three straight years that significant parts of Houston have been underwater. The Memorial Day floods of 2015, the Tax Day flooding last year, and now Hurricane Harvey and the worst flooding in that city on record. Last year, ProPublica Reveal and the Texas Tribune explained how much of that damage is because of the way Houston literally is built. Nina Satija is a reporter for the Texas Tribune and Reveal. We got her on the phone from Houston. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, you've been out and about today in Houston in some of the shelters. What are you seeing?
The shelters are filling up. Our hotel is pretty close to one of the largest Red Cross shelters in the city. They've got about 3,000 people there right now. Yesterday night we were there and they just had 1,000. So it's filling up, and they expect to be at capacity, which is 5,000 later on today. So it's getting a little chaotic.
One of the reasons we called you, besides getting a sense of what's happening on the ground, actually, is the piece from a year or so ago about Houston and why it is so flood prone. There is so much to unpack with this story and why Houston is having the problems it is. What's the overall sense of what's going on?
Yeah, what I would say is Houston has always been a flood prone city. It's a low lying city. It's near the coast. Much of it was swampland. But what's happened over the last 100 years, and I think scientists say has accelerated in the last 20 years, is rapid, unchecked development. And scientists say that that development is making the flooding even worse. The second factor that you have is climate change. Climate change, scientists say, we know, is potentially causing these rainstorms to be more frequent and more severe. So you add on the climate change and the unchecked development to a city that's already prone to flooding, and you've got a big problem.
When you say development, basically it's paving over grasslands and prairies and things that would in theory absorb some of the water or more of the water.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what's happening, and that's what scientists are worried about. And, you know, those prairie lands have very tall grasses. They could absorb an enormous amount of flood water. And so I want to be clear here. even with a lot more prairie land, this would have been probably a catastrophic flood. But scientists agree that, you know, had we been able to just restore more of that and preserve more of that, perhaps the damage would have been less.
Talk to me for a second about regulations on that development, on zoning requirements, on the types of mitigation that you're required to do when you build in Houston. Surely they've got flooding in mind.
They do certainly have flooding in mind. But I would say, you know, scientists have told us that Harris County, which is the county that surrounds Houston, has more lax regulations when it comes to building in the floodplain than some of the surrounding counties. You know, Freeboard is one example. One of the other issues is a lot of folks are building in floodplains and they're just raising their houses, which is fine. But now there's increasing scientific evidence to show that that might actually be causing the surrounding areas to flood. Every scientist and expert that we have talked to, including some government officials, say that the regulations for building in floodplains, building in flood-prone areas in Houston are not sufficient.
Let me get you to the eventual recovery of Houston and that part of Texas when the water goes away. There was already a shortage of construction workers, of folks who can do the actual labor that's going to be required to rebuild Houston. What's your guess? What's your sense on how that's going to go?
Yeah, you know, I just spoke with Senator Ted Cruz, actually, at the Red Cross Emergency Shelter, and there's definitely, you know, some concern about federal resources here. I think we heard the FEMA director say earlier today, this is exceeding, you know, federal capacity for a response. I spoke to a family yesterday that had evacuated from their home in Meyerland, which has seen enormous amount of flooding. And they told me, you know, they tried calling 911, they tried calling 311, nobody ever answered, they could never get through. They ended up getting rescued by a private citizen in a boat, taken to a grocery store. Then they hitched a ride with another volunteer to another pickup center. Then they hitched a ride with another volunteer to the Red Cross shelter. So at no point was the government involved in their rescue.
Nina Satija from the Texas Tribune and Reveal, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The name to know today in corporate America is Dara Khosrowshahi. He is at the moment the CEO of the travel website Expedia. He has been offered, though, a different and somewhat bigger challenge running Uber as it gets itself out from under a barrel full of scandals. We got the new host of Marketplace Tech, Molly Wood, on the phone to make me smart about this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So this guy is, I guess you could call him a sort of an unconventional choice, not a tech guy, not a big name guy. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly hope he isn't coming in thinking, I am so excited as the eighth choice for Uber right. CEO to take the reins here. Because, you know, obviously all of the attention and press was around the big names that they were trying to get, Jeff Immelt and Meg Whitman. What he is, it sounds like, is a really good manager and someone who, at least according to some studies, is extremely likable in the CEO world. And frankly, the benefit of being lesser known is that the expectations won't be so set. You won't have people like us trying to plot his every move before it even happens based on all that we know about him.
Do you believe that, and I suppose you have to, because otherwise would he have taken the, why would he have taken the job? But do you believe Travis Kalanick is going to get the heck out of the way now?
I think that that is the only question that matters here in some ways. It will be so hard to affect actual change at Uber if Travis does not step aside and let that happen. And obviously, there's some really high-profile battling about that right now. It's become increasingly clear that he's been involved in every step of this process. But you have to believe that this guy feels like he can handle it.
Right. So to that end of he can handle it, here's the deal, right? He doesn't need the money because he's doing fine at Expedia. He doesn't necessarily need this job because he's doing fine at Expedia and he's got the backing of Barry Diller. I saw online today, and I can't remember where, otherwise I would have credited this person, that what Khosrowshahi has decided to do here is take on the most difficult CEO job you can think of in this economy right now. What do you make of that?
Yep. There was always going to be a candidate for whom it was too tasty an opportunity to pass up. It's like the climbing Everest of the CEO world at this point. And so for someone, you know, and for him, it's not a trap. You know, somebody like Meg Whitman might have said, look, there's a whole glass cliff situation built in here. It's just something where if he does a great job, there is only upside. And look, the underlying fundamentals of Uber's business are still really strong. there's every reason to believe that this significantly increases the possibility of an IPO and a you know, potentially $100 billion IPO. And if it all falls apart, nobody's going to blame Khosrow Shahi. They're going to blame Travis. So yeah. I think he probably thought it's worth a try.
Molly Wood, she is the brand new host of Marketplace Tech. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
One quick follow. We had Dara Khosrow Shahi on the program back in March for our series Conversations from the Corner Office. You can check it out at marketplace.org or on the Corner Office podcast. Coming up,
Britain led that in a world where that was disapproved of by almost everybody.
Free trade's British beginnings, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off less than a tenth percent today, about 5 points, 21,808. NASDAQ up 2 tenths, 17.6283. The S&P 500 less than a tenth percent to the up, 24.44. Home improvement stocks rallied today in the aftermath of Harvey. Shares of Home Depot and Lowe's climbed. Home Depot up 1.1%. Lowe's saw a gain of 0.6%. American hardwood flooring retailer Lumber Liquidators gained 4.4% today. Shares of Expedia slumped on the news that its chief executive is probably leaving to head up Uber, as we told you. Expedia down 4.5%. The global travel site Trivago down 0.2%. TripAdvisor up about 0.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.15%. How do you like them apples, Janet Yellen? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. This morning, President Trump reversed a high-profile Obama-era policy on policing. Specifically, he's gotten rid of restrictions on state and local police departments getting surplus military gear. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
The program to give surplus military gear to civilian police departments was launched in the 1990s to provide cops more firepower to deal with heavily armed drug dealers and terrorists. It eventually allowed any police department to obtain a wide range of sophisticated military equipment. Lou Ryder, a former deputy chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, says overall it's been a good program.
They offered equipment that many police departments could reasonably use,
like night vision goggles, riot gear, and high-powered weapons. But after military-equipped police were seen deployed in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, the Obama administration banned transfers of some high-powered military equipment and restricted the use of what was still permitted. Charles Wilson, who chairs the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers, says that was the right move to help demilitarize local policing.
Grenade launchers, bayonets. Having that type of equipment present creates another barrier, if you will, to successful community policing.
Robert Kane, chair of criminology at Drexel University, says most police departments don't face severe enough crime to need sophisticated military gear like armored personnel carriers. But once they get it, departments
integrate these big military assets into their daily patrol functions.
And he says with city budgets tight, police chiefs will hardly ever say no to military gear for their officers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
While free trade might sound like an American concept, we are, in fact, relative newbies to this economic phenomenon. Free trade was born more than 170 years ago in the northern English city of Manchester, where the movement to get rid of import tariffs and other trade barriers began, originally with outrage over something called the Corn Laws. It sounds ancient, arcane even, but its repercussions around the world continue to this day, and it is the next story in our series, Trade-Off, Who Wins and Who Loses in Global Trade. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has it from the busy streets of Manchester.
On this busy street in the city centre stands Manchester's most beautiful building in glorious sandstone with Italianate arcades and richly decorated with carved figures. It's not quite what you'd expect to find in the world's first industrial city, a place once infamous for its smoke-belching chimneys. The building celebrates the birth here of a big idea, and, says tour guide Elizabeth Sibbering, proclaims it with a bold inscription across the facade.
In big gold letters on the top, it says Free Trade Hall, and we think that's probably the only building in the whole world that's named after free trade. Usually it's named after monarchs or places or something like that. Manchester, Radical Manchester, free trade. So it's written on our city.
The hall, which today is a five-star hotel, was built in the mid-19th century to commemorate a victory. Victory for the Manchester men. They were the emerging class of merchants and manufacturers, and it was their fight in the 1840s against the British aristocracy that launched the movement against tariffs and trade barriers.
Today, this vast Victorian cotton mill at Quarry Bank, south of the city, is a tourist attraction. Tens of thousands of visitors come here and are bemused by the clattering, wheezing Rube Goldberg machinery. But in the 1840s, says Mike Sanders of Manchester University, people marvelled at this scene. This was the future.
There is something awe-inspiring. There is something truly remarkable and amazing about the machinery, the precision, the way in which it produces cloth in quantities that previously could not have been dreamt of.
And produced undreamt of wealth. The new textile tycoons resented the old money and the power of the landed aristocracy, and they resented the steep tariffs that those aristocrats had fought to get. They'd made grain more expensive to bolster the profits of the crops grown on their land. Those corn laws, as these tariffs were called, also pushed up the price of bread, with devastating consequences for the poor.
We ask our daily bread.
This protest song from the 1840s says it all, lamenting the widespread starvation and angrily blaming the aristocracy.
Answer ye lordlings gay, ye useless idle few.
But why should the kings of cotton, who were hardly enlightened employers, be concerned about the high price of grain?
The merchantcy didn't like that because it meant that they had to keep wages high as well to keep their workers going, in a way.
The cotton mill owners had a keen commercial interest in wanting to scrap the corn laws, says Elizabeth Sibbling.
They could see what problems it was causing for their workers. They couldn't afford to eat.
Workers and bosses, bankers and lawyers, politicians, churchmen and social reformers joined the crusade against the corn laws. It was a fight for cheaper food, a battle against the aristocracy, and for the textile tycoons in particular, a drive towards free trade. They wanted other countries to scrap their tariffs and throw open their markets to British goods. Like all good crusaders, says Mike Sanders, they convinced themselves that God was on their side.
It was the belief that the good Lord had made the world in such a way that the nations were supposed to trade, and anything that impeded free trade was harmful to the human race as a whole, and in their view, it was manifest in the form of people who were going hungry in one of the richest countries in the world.
The crusade crushed the aristocratic opposition. The Corn Laws were repealed in 1846. Foreign grain poured into Britain. Much of it came eventually from the former colony that supplied the Manchester mills with most of their raw cotton. Will Ashworth is author of a new book about the Industrial Revolution.
With the rapid influx of prairie grain from the USA, that impacted upon the social structure of Britain. You saw the demise of the landowner and the rise of the middling ranks and the owners of production due to the cheap imports now coming from the prairie lands of the United States of America to Britain.
The American Revolution, about 100 years after it had happened, finally humbled the British aristocracy, much to the satisfaction of the British manufacturing and commercial classes. But the repeal of the Corn Laws did not persuade the rest of the world to immediately follow suit, much to the chagrin of free traders.
My name is Adrian Wooldridge. I'm the political editor of The Economist. The Economist was founded in 1843 to pursue the case against the Corn Laws.
Yes, The Economist is part of this story. It was created to be the voice of the anti-Corn Law crusade. The irony, says Wooldridge, is that the foreign country that profited most from the repeal of those laws did not embark on the same programme of tariff scrapping.
We think of America as being the sort of the great capitalist power, but in fact America was a country that was opposed to free trade right the way through the 19th century and all the way up to 1945. Britain was the first country to embrace it and to say the best way to create universal prosperity is to have freedom of commerce and trade, and Britain led that in a world where that was disapproved of by almost everybody.
Britain may not have been high-minded in opposing the Corn Laws. The main aim may have been to exploit its industrial power, to flood other countries with its manufactured goods while they focus their energies on agriculture. If that was the plan, it has, in the long term, spectacularly backfired. Britain today has a large trade deficit. Its manufacturing is a pale shadow of its former self. Oh, and more than half of its food, including grain, comes from abroad. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, President Trump had a quick press conference this afternoon, a joint appearance with the president of Finland. He was asked about rebuilding Houston, said it's going to be beautiful. He was asked about the Arpaio pardon, he said, and this is a quote, he did it on Friday night with the hurricane on the way because he thought the ratings would be higher, and he was asked about the wall.
If I may follow up, on Tuesday you said, if we have to close down our government, we are building that wall.
Well,
if
I hope that's not necessary.
Wall, let me just tell you. Our government?
Yeah, I hope that's not necessary. If it's necessary, we'll have to see. But I hope it's not necessary.
Congress is back a week from tomorrow. All right, we are out of here. Wall Street basically awash today. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.